Welcome back to the MCG Pediatric Podcast. My name is Sara Atari, and I'm a medical student here at the Medical College of Georgia. On today's episode, we will be discussing community-acquired pneumonia in the pediatric population. I am delighted to have Dr. Fahim Thower join the discussion today. Dr. Thower is currently a pediatric resident here at MCG and will be attending fellowship in pediatric hospital medicine after graduation. Welcome, Fahim.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
I also have the pleasure of introducing one of our pediatric faculty members. Dr. Jake Eichenberger is an associate professor of pediatrics at MCG and a pediatric hospitalist at the Children's Hospital of Georgia.
Thank you for the introduction, Sara. Community-acquired pneumonia is definitely a common condition I see as a hospitalist, and our goals for today's episode will be to help listeners recognize common history and physical exam findings associated with community-acquired pneumonia, be able to formulate a differential diagnosis, understand the initial diagnostic approach and treatment, and finally, briefly discuss prognosis and prevention. So, Sara, what do you know about community-acquired pneumonia?
Pneumonia in general is defined as signs and symptoms of an acute infection of the pulmonary parenchyma. Its causes can be bacterial, viral, or fungal.
That's a good explanation, Sara. So when we talk about community acquired, we're attempting to distinguish a pneumonia acquired in the community versus one acquired in a healthcare setting. And because of this, the treatment can be different.
That's exactly right, Fahim. Community-acquired pneumonia is one of the most common causes of death in children worldwide. In fact, it counts for 15% of deaths in children younger than 5 years of age. Roughly 4 out of every 100 children under the age of 5 will have a community-acquired pneumonia at some point, and this is especially a significant cause of morbidity and mortality in developing countries.
Wow, yeah. I've never appreciated the severity of pneumonia and how large of a problem it is. It seems like many of these cases are treated with antibiotics at home and do not typically become severe enough to warrant hospitalization. So how would a pediatrician make the decision to admit to the hospital?
That's a good question, Sara. And you're right, most of these children can be successfully treated outpatient, but some of them will require hospitalization. And fortunately, we have some great evidence-based decision-making tools to help determine who may need to be admitted that we'll discuss those tools later on. But before we get into any more details, why don't you start us out with a clinical case?
You got it. We have a 5-year-old male who presents to an outpatient clinic with 3 days of cough, runny nose, and a fever. He has no associated abdominal pain, sore throat, or dysuria. The mother is worried because he has not been eating or sleeping well during this time, and she became concerned when he began breathing funny this morning. His younger brother had the same symptoms a week ago, but has since recovered.
Oh, this is a great case. There are obviously some type of respiratory illness occurring with our patient. Fahim, how would you start the assessment and what physical exam findings would be concerning for your respiratory exam?
Yeah, so the physical exam and vital signs should all be included in the primary assessment. And really what I would be particularly worried about are signs of increased work of breathing. And this could be tachypnea, chest retractions, nasal flaring, or abdominal breathing. I'd also look for decreased breath sounds over areas of the lung and possibly crackles. These could all indicate that the child is not getting enough air into the lungs. Vital signs I would specifically be wary of are fever, low oxygen saturation, tachypnea, and tachycardia. Although many children may not develop acute symptoms, it is important for a general pediatrician to be vigilant of signs that may indicate acute respiratory decompensation, since these patients will require intervention as soon as possible.
Okay, so based on your initial assessment of our 5-year-old with 3 days of fever, respiratory symptoms, and poor oral intake, what's on your differential diagnosis list?
Sure, so differential diagnoses to consider are an acute asthma exacerbation, pneumonia, a viral upper respiratory infection, and bronchiolitis, and these are in no particular order of likelihood. Other non-respiratory considerations would be an acute otitis media or even sinusitis.
That's a good start. What's something else that looks like respiratory distress but is not an infection and that we might need to keep in mind for our younger children?
Well, as we all know, kids are always putting things in their mouth, so do you mean a foreign body ingestion?
That's exactly what I was thinking. Foreign body aspiration is definitely a can't-miss diagnosis, and the reason I mention this is because the treatment would differ. Urgent removal of a foreign body by ENT or some other specialist would be warranted in that case. For these cases, a child may also present with similar symptoms such as coughing or difficulty breathing, but a fever would be much less likely with an ingested foreign body. So we'll say that foreign body ingestion has been ruled out. What else can help us narrow our differential?
Okay, so the medical history would also be important, right? Things such as chronic medical conditions like asthma or allergies. We should also ask about both over-the-counter and prescription medications the child is taking and if he's up to date on his immunizations.
I agree. What are some of the ways to differentiate between the possible causes of his symptoms?
What about a chest x-ray? Wouldn't this be helpful to differentiate a pneumonia from an upper respiratory infection?
Sure. You know, a chest x-ray is something we can definitely consider. But really in pediatrics, we're always considering how to minimize invasive evaluations and interventions. For example, could we avoid the radiation from a chest x-ray if the physical exam and clinical history clearly indicates that this is in fact pneumonia?
Yeah, that's a great point, Fahim. Let's not forget about the power of the physical exam. If the patient comes in with a fever and we have crackles heard over a single portion of the lung, then with some combination of a productive cough, dyspnea, retractions, or decreased oxygen saturation, we could make a clinical diagnosis of pneumonia without doing a chest x-ray. However, the diagnosis of pneumonia in young children may be difficult at times, which could delay the start of appropriate treatment.
Right, so some children may not be cooperative on exam. They may be crying or squirming around so much that you could miss fine crackles on auscultation. So clinical history with addition of labs and chest x-ray may be helpful if the clinical diagnosis isn't clear.
Okay, I gotcha. Good to know. Now back to our case. So let's say for our patient, we auscultate and hear crackles in the right lower lung field and diminished breath sounds that are concerning for pneumonia. So what's next?
As we mentioned earlier, it's not recommended to routinely get a chest x-ray for an uncomplicated community acquired pneumonia. So that's because a chest x-ray would not really drastically change management, since it really does not help distinguish a viral versus a bacterial cause.
That's right. However, if the child appears very ill or if the diagnosis is still questionable, a chest x-ray may be helpful. It would at least establish a baseline in case complications such as pleural effusions develop.
Okay, so what about labs?
So again, that depends on how the child presents. You know, if the child has vital signs that are concerning, like tachycardia or tachypnea, then I think obtaining labs would be helpful in understanding the severity of their illness. Important labs to consider are a CBC and even a CRP to understand the degree of leukocytosis in such patients, and even electrolytes if we are worried about dehydration. Although blood cultures have been shown in the past to have low utility, they should be considered in a workup if the patient is septic or if the clinical provider is concerned about bacteremia.
We mentioned earlier that pneumonia could be due to viral, bacterial, or fungal causes. So how exactly do we determine that?
That's another great question, Sarah. Actually, the age of a patient can help you narrow down the pathogen. In other words, different age groups are more susceptible to either viral or bacterial pneumonia. And pneumonia in neonates younger than 3 weeks of age most often are caused by an infection obtained from the mother at birth, specifically group B strep. Fahim, what's the most common pathogen for pneumonia in infants 3 weeks to 3 months old?
So that would be Streptococcus pneumoniae as well as viruses. In fact, viruses are the most frequent cause of pneumonia in preschool age children. And this includes respiratory syncytial virus, also known as RSV, influenza, human metapneumovirus, and currently we definitely can't forget about COVID-19.
Sara, do you know the most common bacterial pathogens of pneumonia in older children?
The most common bacterial causes include Streptococcus pneumoniae, Haemophilus influenza, and Moraxella catarrhalis, right?
That's right. Great job. For children older than 5, we also have to remember Mycoplasma, and for infants, we can't forget about the possibility of chlamydia pneumonia.
Okay, so what about our fungal causes of pneumonia in children?
So fungal causes of pneumonia in children most commonly includes coccidioides, histoplasmosis, aspergillosis, and pneumocystis jirovecii, commonly known as PCP. Pneumocystis jirovecii is an important and potentially deadly cause of fungal pneumonia in immunocompromised patients.
Sara, which population of children do you think are the most vulnerable to developing pneumonia?
The group that's first coming to mind are unvaccinated children, making them more susceptible to pneumonia from strep pneumonia, H flu, or influenza. Other than that, I'm not quite sure.
Oh, well, that's a great place to start. Some other vulnerable populations include the immunocompromised individuals we mentioned earlier, children with cardiopulmonary disorders such as cystic fibrosis, asthma, or sickle cell disease, children with congenital heart disease, and children exposed to secondhand smoke.
Wow, yeah, so that really speaks to the importance of childhood immunizations. So let me quickly summarize what we've talked about so far. In general, the diagnosis of pneumonia can be made through the clinical exam. Labs and chest x-rays can be helpful if the diagnosis is unclear, rule out other possible non-infectious causes such as foreign body aspiration, or help narrow down the pathogen causing the pneumonia.
That's right, Sarah.
So once a diagnosis of pneumonia is made, how do we decide if the child needs to be admitted to the hospital versus treatment as an outpatient?
So that's a good question. I think the clinical factors to determine if a patient should be admitted to the hospital would be things like if the patient is showing signs of respiratory distress, specifically breathing faster than the normal range for his or her age, or breathing so hard that they are having signs of chest retractions, especially over suprasternal, intercostal, or subcostal areas.
That's right. We always start with assessing the child's airway, breathing, and circulation. This is to ensure that no immediate intervention is required, such as escalating respiratory support, like intubating the child, or administering fluid boluses if the patient appears septic or severely dehydrated.
And other considering signs could be nasal flaring, change in behavior, such as lethargy, or even having difficulty maintaining oxygen saturations above 90% on room air. Sometimes these kids may also be at risk for dehydration because they've been vomiting so much and they can't tolerate anything by mouth.
That's a good point about oral intake, Fahim. Earlier, we mentioned that our child did not present with abdominal pain, but that is actually a pretty common symptom, especially in children with lower lobe pneumonias that might lead to poor oral intake. Those children may need IV fluids or antibiotics if they appear ill enough. So a child with some of these more severe symptoms may need to be admitted to the hospital, specifically a child that we think needs IV antibiotics or IV fluids due to the inability to tolerate oral intake.
A child who needs supplemental oxygen or is working very hard to breathe should also be admitted. And if there's significant concern from the physician or even from the parents, you can also admit for observation. And based on the severity of these symptoms, we would consider the general inpatient floor versus the intensive care unit.
Okay, got it. These are all great points to keep in mind.
So Sarah, can you give us an update on the results of the evaluation and how our patient is doing?
Absolutely. So we have our 5-year-old child who presented with 3 days of cough, shortness of breath, runny nose, and fever. He is noted to be tachypneic with the respiratory rate of 35, which is high for his age. Pulse oximetry reading is concerning for oxygen saturation of 86% on room air. He appears tired, but is still cooperative. While resting, he is noted to have subcostal retractions, and there are crackles in the right lower lung on auscultation. A chest x-ray confirms a right lower lobe focal consolidation. Labs, including his blood culture, are still pending. So I think we can all agree that this child will be admitted to the inpatient hospitalist unit for further management. Where do we go from here?
A patient with community-acquired pneumonia with oxygen saturations below 92% on room air should really be administered supplemental oxygen. And typically we start with a nasal cannula and we can titrate down as they improve.
Starting the patient on IV fluids is also reasonable since most of these patients will have inadequate oral hydration and likely receive IV antibiotics at least briefly. Also watch the blood pressure and heart rate, especially for hypotension and tachycardia, as some of these patients may meet SIRS criteria and require fluid boluses or other support. Sarah, really briefly, could you explain to our listeners what the SIRS criteria is and its significance?
Yeah, so SIRS stands for Systemic Inflammatory Response Syndrome and is defined by the presence of at least two of the following criteria. So one, being body temperature greater than 38 degrees Celsius. Two, being a heart rate greater than 90 beats per minute. Three, being respiratory rate greater than 20 breaths per minute or PaCO2 of less than 32 millimeters mercury. Four, leukocyte count greater than 12,000 or less than 4,000 per microliter or greater than 10% bandemia.
Wow, that's a really good explanation, Sarah. Additionally, SIRS criteria plus a suspected source of infection would be concerning for sepsis. So sepsis with organ dysfunction, hypotension, or hyperperfusion is what we call severe sepsis. And finally, septic shock is defined as severe sepsis with hypotension despite adequate fluid resuscitation.
But remember that most kids that get admitted to the hospital are going to meet all of the criteria for SIRS, but may not have all the clinical criteria to be actually septic.
And children with pneumonia may decompensate quickly and require more advanced care in the pediatric intensive care unit if they begin showing signs of sepsis or septic shock. And these patients are at risk for development of acute respiratory distress syndrome, or what we call ARDS. Sarah, what do you know about ARDS?
Well, ARDS in simple terms occurs when fluid accumulates in the alveoli causing surfactant dysfunction, and this leads to the inability of adequate oxygenation.
Yeah, exactly. And oftentimes these patients will then need to be intubated or in some cases even placed on ECMO.
It's important to know that in general, few of these kids actually end up in the PICU, especially if evaluated, diagnosed, and treated promptly. Most cases of pneumonia that require hospitalization are okay on the general inpatient floor.
So you mentioned earlier possibly starting IV antibiotics initially, especially if the child looks very ill. Would we start with something broad spectrum while waiting for the blood culture results?
Yeah, that's a good question. Recent studies have shown that ampicillin should actually be initiated for fully immunized infants or school-aged children admitted to the hospital floor with community-acquired pneumonia.
Yes, per the WHO, empiric therapy with ampicillin or another aminopenicillin can be administered for the following categories of patients. 1, those who are hospitalized. 2, those who are not fully immunized. 3, infants and children with life-threatening infection, including those with empyema. And a third-generation cephalosporin, such as ceftriaxone or cefotaxime, can also be prescribed in place of ampicillin.
Okay, so how long would we treat with antibiotics?
So, you know, we can typically prescribe an antibiotic for 10 days, but there is some data out there and ongoing research about shortening this duration. In the hospital, typically an IV form of the antibiotic is started, and once the child begins to show signs of improvement, we can transition the child to an oral form of the antibiotic. So, for example, if we started with ampicillin, we could transition to oral amoxicillin as soon as the child is able to tolerate PO.
Okay, gotcha. How long does the patient need to be hospitalized for?
Yeah, so that depends on how quickly the child improves and if there are any complications. But typically, these children will be admitted to the hospital between 24 and 72 hours. And Fahim is a future hospitalist and potential colleague. What are important criteria that should be met before discharging a patient with pneumonia?
So the length of stay is influenced by how well the patient is responding to antibiotic therapy. And it really also depends on how quickly the child is showing clinical signs of improvement. So things like decreased work of breathing or no longer needing supplemental oxygen. We also need to monitor their ability to tolerate oral hydration and medications.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. This, of course, is for the most common pneumonias. So if the patient is worsening or failing to improve with therapy, it would be important to begin considering other causes, including mycoplasma or Staph aureus.
That's a great point. So what would be a complication that would require a child to stay in the hospital longer?
So some severe complications of pneumonia are empyema, pneumothorax, lung abscesses, and bronchopleural fistulas. And this is why it's so important to make sure that the patient is on the appropriate antibiotics and is clinically improving with thorough monitoring of vital signs and frequent physical exams.
I agree. Other things to watch out for are persistent fevers, crackles on physical exam, respiratory distress, and the inability to be weaned off of supplemental oxygen.
Yeah, and at that point, I think we should consider broadening the antibiotic therapy.
A repeat chest x-ray might also be helpful to investigate for complications of pneumonia, including the pleural effusion I mentioned earlier, an empyema, abscess, or a pneumothorax. Both an empyema and an abscess need to be treated aggressively with IV antibiotics and may need to be drained with a chest tube, depending on the size. Bronchoscopy can be utilized as a diagnostic tool to determine the infectious cause of the abscess and to aid with antibiotic selection. And as we mentioned earlier, sepsis and ARDS are potential severe complications of pneumonia that would require more advanced and prolonged care.
Okay, so I think I have a good grasp on what to do about the ill-appearing child with community-acquired pneumonia, but what if the child has a clinical diagnosis but does not appear ill and in respiratory distress?
The current recommendation for treatment of community-acquired pneumonia in the outpatient setting are beta-lactam antibiotics. So, for example, this would typically be amoxicillin in the higher dose range between 80 to 100 milligrams per kilo per day, divided 2 or 3 times for 10 days. And this dosing can be as high as 4 grams per day.
Okay. What about other medications, such as albuterol? Would that be helpful?
We use albuterol as an adrenergic bronchodilator used to treat or prevent bronchospasm in patients with clinically symptomatic asthma. In very general terms, albuterol helps relieve wheezing and trouble breathing by increasing the flow of air through the bronchial tubes. Albuterol has not been shown to help significantly in patients without asthma in several studies, but monitoring the patient for signs of hypoxic respiratory failure is something all physicians should be vigilant about. So essentially, remember that albuterol does not treat pneumonia, but is only a temporary measure to improve breathing status, and symptoms will keep returning until the infection clears.
Good to know. So what's the prognosis of children with community-acquired pneumonia?
You know, thankfully, the children who are otherwise healthy and get community-acquired pneumonia have a great prognosis, even if they did require hospital admission or had complications.
Right. The readmission rate within 30 days of discharge is about 3% for patients who are readmitted for pneumonia and about 8% for patients readmitted for all causes.
Why do patients get readmitted?
Yeah, and so the most common population that will get readmitted are children less than a year of age and those with chronic medical conditions. Noncompliance with the prescribed antibiotic treatment may also be another reason.
And remember to counsel your families regarding vaccine-preventable infections. Immunizations have played a major role in the prevention of community-acquired pneumonia, especially for those organisms that can lead to poor outcomes, such as the ones we mentioned before, Haemophilus influenza type B and strep pneumo.
Right, and you know, I did read an interesting study from Spain which found that for those children who were immunized against pneumococcal disease, or in other words, received the Prevnar or pneumococcal vaccine, there was a significant reduction in the number of patients admitted to the hospital for pneumonia. Overall, we are fortunate to have vaccines that have helped us to reduce invasive disease and mortality rates.
Yes, that's so important to emphasize. Wow, this whole discussion has been really informative. I've learned a lot today, but it's already time to begin wrapping up our episode, so let's summarize some key points for our listeners.
Awesome, I'll get us started. Pneumonia refers to the presence of signs and symptoms of an acute infection of the pulmonary parenchyma in an individual. It can be caused by bacteria, virus, or even fungi.
For those patients presenting with respiratory distress, it's important to consider pneumonia in your differential diagnoses. In general, the diagnosis of pneumonia can be made by clinical examination with the help of labs and chest radiography.
And outpatient treatment includes prescribing a course of a beta-lactam antibiotic, such as amoxicillin, in addition to supportive care with aggressive oral hydration.
For those that present with respiratory distress and are ill-appearing, inpatient admission with initial IV antibiotics, fluids, and supplemental oxygen if needed, and supportive care is necessary to prevent worsening symptoms.
And children who are otherwise healthy and get community-acquired pneumonia have a great prognosis, even if they required hospital admission or had complications.
All right, that's a perfect summary. Thank you again, Dr. Thauer and Dr. Eichenberger, for joining me on today's episode to discuss your experience with community-acquired pneumonia in children.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and me too. I enjoyed our discussion.
And an additional thank you to Dr. Rebecca Yang and Dr. Catherine McLeod, who provided peer review on today's discussion. Thank you all for listening to this episode from the Department of Pediatrics at the Medical College of Georgia. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at mcgpediatricpodcast@augusta.edu. Remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as medical advice to diagnose or treat any particular patient. Clinical vignette cases presented are based on hypothetical patient scenarios. Follow the link in our show notes for free CME credit for today's episode. We look forward to speaking to you on our next episode of the MCG Pediatric Podcast.